Hey, how you doing? Thanks for downloading the show. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio, eclectic DIY and anything else that pops into our head. How's that for a show? I'm Eric. I host this podcast and a YouTube channel called Garden Fork as well. Today, my co-host Rick is joining me. Hello, sir.
Sorry. Hello, friends. Eric is the one that was coughing a while ago, but all of a sudden I had a fit. How are you, my friend?
I'm just getting over a massive cold. It was not COVID, thankfully, but it just about felt like it. So I can finally talk again. So here we are.
Yeah, I am glad you're back.
Yay, I'm glad you're here, sir, because we're going to talk about biogas digesters and then read some viewer mail, and we'll go from there.
Okay, excellent. What is a biogas digester?
It's something that's been in my mind since I was probably 10 or 12 years old. Back in the day, my father would get Popular Mechanics magazine.
Yeah.
And there was an article in there of a guy who, I think the son, you know, father and son team, but the son, they have a cow farm, and he took a, you know, 55-gallon drum, put some valves on it, and connected a hose that went to a rubber inner tube that went around the barrel, and then another line to a gas stove that had a gas burner that had been modified for low pressure gas. And they were fermenting, well, ferment is not the right word. They were processing manure into making methane and several other gases that are produced at the same time. And so he had a little cast iron burner and they could, you know, cook fruit or whatever. And that design has been in my head for more years than I want to share. And then yesterday, YouTube thought that I should watch a video about making a biogas digester. And several years ago, there's a farm near me called the Freund Farm, where they have a dairy farm. And they have a huge biogas digester that heats the greenhouses and their retail store.
Wow. You know, anytime you drive around in a rural area and you see a black polyethylene tarp, ground cloth, spread out over a large area with a bubble in the center of it, it just looks like it's inflated, that's more than likely a biodigester.
So we should talk about what it is. It's basically you're taking either cow or horse manure, animal manure, or vegetable scraps, that kind of thing, and some water, and you're letting, I believe it's, let's just call them organisms, because I don't know the name of what the bugs are that do it, but they eat the material in this slushy mix in your barrel, and they emit what's basically called methane. So then they call that biogas, and they create methane plus several other gases as well. One of them is sulfuric, something other sulfite, which gives it the stinky smell, basically.
Right. Essentially, what's happening here is you're just collecting the gases from rotting matter.
Yes.
Yeah, bacteria eat the wood, the cellulose. It can be cow manure, cow urine, horse urine, dog poo. There is actually in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a dog park that has a MIT-designed biogas unit. And you put the poo in one side, and you turn the handle every now and then to kind of mix things up. It has a paddle. And they have a gas lamp post in the center of the dog park that's run off the biogas. And during the winter, they, like you were talking about your friend that had a stove, they have a stove there for people to heat their water for hot tea and coffee and that kind of thing while the dogs play.
I love it.
Yeah.
So are you going to build one?
Well, I've thought about it. There are precautions. It's a very low pressure system.
Yes.
But you can go to extremes that make it dangerous. I think 2 weeks ago in North Texas, a biogas collection outfit blew up at a dairy farm and killed 18,000 cows. But that was an enormous collection system, and I'm not sure what happened, but they were collecting all the manure and urine from this enormous dairy herd. And a lot of them, there was a sale on beef that day. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea, but a small one that's properly designed, that has pop off valves and that type of thing, they're really quite easy to make. Where is this? You sent me this interesting link.
I sent you, I kind of overlinked you today, but one of the YouTube videos I watched is a gentleman, I think in Kurdistan, and very knowledgeable about biogas digesters. He might be a professor at a university, but the video is a half hour long. I watched it at 1.25 speed, which was kind of like making it run faster, like a YouTube edit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they basically take a big plastic barrel with a slightly smaller plastic barrel. They cut the tops of them open. The narrower one slides just inside the larger one. They put some input and output holes with pipes on the lower one. They fill it with cow manure and water, and it starts digesting. And then from that point on, they have a 4-inch fill pipe that goes into the bottom of the digester. And the guy literally was in his kitchen whizzing up all the composty matter from his kitchen and pouring it in. It looked like a smoothie kind of consistency. And he pours it in the 4-inch pipe, and then they have an overflow on the other side of the digester at the top into a bucket. So you're putting in new material, and the composted, anaerobically composted fertilizer comes out the top of the overflow pipe. So as soon as you add in more material every day, you get a little bit of fertilizer that comes out the other side, dilute that with water, and you can apply it to your plants, which I loved.
Yeah, no kidding. This appeals to my little heart because I am all about the virtuous cycle. Throw away as little as you can, reuse what you can. And that particularly goes for vegetable trimmings, coffee grounds, all that stuff out of the kitchen. I go for worms, making compost from it. But I also have been attracted to this idea of a biodigester just to make sure that the methane that's released from it is somehow used and not just shot off into the atmosphere.
Right, because methane is part of the climate change problem.
Right.
I'm not quite sure on the science of that, but I know that and carbon dioxide are causing a lot of our problems right now with the climate crisis.
Right. You're not going to make an enormous difference, but for me, it's recapturing and reusing something that would have been thrown away and getting something for it. And if I could install a little gas lamp in the backyard that was lit all the time, that wouldn't be such a bad thing.
No, I'd love that. What I also liked, the gentleman in the 30-minute video, which I will link to in our show notes here, is he showed how to retrofit a regular gas stove to accept biogas. And all you do is, if you're familiar with the term jets, I mean, the jets are in a carburetor, they're in a gas valve, but what they're doing is they're, when you open the valve, the gas has to go through a very small, fine hole to get to the burner. And you just remove the jets on your valves. And then typically on the pipe that's going to the burner, there is an adjustable air valve. It allows, you can dial in or out. Like if you're doing a propane stove and the flame is too yellow, you can close down the air vent underneath the burner, and that will make it burn hotter, I believe. And so he taped those shut because the bile gas is at such a low pressure when right. it's coming out of the when it's coming out of the digester. It's basically weight on the upper barrel. They put this guy put a big old car tire. You could put bricks or weights or whatever. And you're pressing down on the gas to go into a hose. And he fired up this gas stove running on his biodigester, which I loved.
You know, this goes way off base, but it reminds me that my favorite philosopher, Eric Hoffer, said that it's people on the outside, on the edges of society, that are the most innovative. And I really think that's true, you know. You see, guys, you know, biodigesters, solar hot water made from essentially bottles that are kind of glued together on the roofs of buildings and stuff. Yeah. Just all kinds of things in the third world that, and, you know, the just use and reuse and keep reusing. Kids taking old generators and making wind generators out of them. You know, just by necessity, sometimes they are just so tremendously inventive.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
There it is. That's is that original?
No. No, but it's, hey, I need to do this thing.
Yeah. Eric Hoffer is just one of those amazing people. He wrote a book called The True Believer in 1952. And before that, he had been a migrant worker in California, picking grapes and beans and that kind of thing. He did a turn of gold mining up in the hills of California. When World War II started, he couldn't enlist. He had a hernia or something. They wouldn't enlist him. And so he went to work as a longshoreman. And during the day, and this is back when longshoremen did the heavy work. I mean, you know, literally... you know, you see those old movies where they have the cargo nets that are filled with stuff, and they mm-hmm. lift them up into the ship and they drop them down, and then somebody unloads them, and then they refill the cargo nets. It was that that was all the automation. It was
pre-container.
Yeah, pre-container. And he spent almost 25 years loading cargo ships at night or during the day, and at night he wrote philosophy. And he's kind of referred to as the longshoreman philosopher, and a real working man kind of philosopher. And he's just infinitely interesting, and quite insightful. So anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I just thought that was a for me an interesting sideline. But check out Eric Hoffer if you want to see how things are on the edge of society and how inventive they are.
Yeah, I mean it's use what you got. They're like, okay, we want this thing. What can we make happen?
Yeah,
I love that.
So, and you know, just not, well, you know, I can't do anything until I have a $60,000 truck, you know. But they'll figure out a way.
Yeah.
I knew back, I mean, this is, you're too young, I think, to remember Pathé little movie tune videos that were before the main movie. And
The newsreels.
Newsreels, yeah. Back before the movies, they'd have a cartoon, they'd have a newsreel. And I can remember being in the audience back during Vietnam, when the French were still there, and watching these videos coming out of there of, you know, these mountain people disassembling cannons and dragging them up to the top of mountains and doing this repeatedly over and over and over. And that became the siege of Dien Bien Phu, which was the ruin of the French army in Vietnam.
Yes.
And I said, my God, you know, if people are that determined and that inventive, there was no chance for the French, and there wasn't much chance for us. So,
yeah, they have more of a vested interest than the French or the Americans did. So,
yeah, no kidding.
They live there.
Well, what else is going on? You said you had letters.
Right. I want to do one more little comment about the biogas. On Instructables,
no.
On Instructables, there are at least two biogas DIY plans. One of them, the text is way too much. I wanted more pictures. And he was like, do this and this. It's like six paragraphs on how to build something. I'm like, just show me the picture.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
So everyone, I got over a really bad cold. So if I feel weird, but recently we've got some letters. I'm not going to mention the people's names because I don't always know if they want that or not. But I wanted to start out here. We talked a while ago about induction cooktops.
Yes.
And I got one. It says, we switched from a good Gen Air gas range to our KitchenAid induction range a year ago. It was expensive, but we love it. My wife loves the flat top, which is so easy to clean. I love how quickly it heats up our pans and lets me sear and stir fry within seconds of turning on a burner. Wow. We also have controls that allow easy settings for simmer and keep warm. I use a paper towel to control splatters with no fear of fire. Oh, yeah. The left two burners can be bridged to heat our griddle for pancakes. I don't like how it beeps when anything touches a control area, but it's a small price to pay for the other cooking conveniences. The oven is huge and has a convection option. The drawer also heats, but is too shallow for most of our pans. I would buy it again.
Wow. See, a testimonial. We're eyeing induction right now, and we're kind of weighing the options, seeing which one best suits us. They are a little pricey, but right now my gas range, one valve is frozen, and when we tried to take it out and replace the valve, it was all the fittings were corroded, and I'm afraid to fool with it. And now it's not lighting the one of the burners, and I'm in the oven, so it has two ovens, and one of them is not lighting for some reason. And I'm like, well, maybe it's time for us to think about replacing this. And you know, as people get older, or as if you have little kids who are forgetful, it's often best to have appliances that are a little more safe than you know, what you may have had when you're in middle adulthood.
Live fire, yeah.
Live
Don't
fire.
Don't put your hand there.
Yeah, or I remember my little brother decades ago. We were so small, we pulled that drawer out on the bottom. It's supposed to be the warming drawer.
Uh-huh.
And we would stand on it, and eventually to cook. And eventually it got too hot, and we were boiling water for hot dogs. And the oven, or the range, tipped over. And it spilled that hot water all over my brother's legs, scalded him terrible. And so I've always been mindful that, you know, things can happen. You know, it's just as we got older and we got in the habit of pulling that thing out, we just got heavier and heavier and heavier. And eventually that leverage just popped it right over on its side. This is before they started requiring no tip over connections on the walls.
Yes.
And so, yeah. And yeah, he still got the scar from that.
Oops. Erin, the impatient gardener, I don't know if she's bought it yet, but she was looking at induction cooktops. The other thing, natural gas and propane, I believe, have a corrosive element to them, and that's why the burner adjuster valves corrode like that. I could be wrong.
Yeah, and you know, I was a little worried about getting a glass top because all the inductions are glass top of some sort, kind of like an electric stove with a heating element underneath it, but it was pointed out in one of the articles that, you know, it doesn't get that hot on top of it like it does with a heating element underneath
it.
And so they're easier to keep clean and keep looking good. Nothing bakes on, and then you scratch the glass trying to get all that stuff off. So I'm thinking about it. Plus, I just like new things. I've always been attracted to shiny new things and projects. I want to know how they work. I have a billion apps on my phones and iPad and whatnot. I have to be careful, delete them every now and then. But if something new happens, I want to see it. I want to try it. I want to see how it works. I want to understand. And so I have to be careful to be sure and delete all that stuff because they're probably tattling on me.
Hey, real quick, one easy way to support Garden Fork is if you're going to shop online and use Amazon, please use the link to our storefront. The link is in the show notes here. If you click on that, it'll open it up in your web browser. If you're on a laptop or desktop, it will open it up into your app, ideally, if you're using the Amazon mobile app. Please shop locally. I go to my local hardware store first. If I can't find it there, then I go to the orange or blue store. If I can't find it there, then I order it online. So if you are shopping online, use our Amazon link, amazon.com/shop/gardenfork. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you. All right. Our next one, I just got recently. We did a show about me, my path to an antidepressant, and I just had my follow-up virtual call with my nurse practitioner.
I offered to sit in on that with you.
I know.
To offer help and advice, and for some reason you didn't take me up on it.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm trying not to choke. But anyway, I got a couple of nice notes about that, so I just wanted to read one of them, and then we can talk a little bit about what's going on so far. I just finished listening to you and Rick talking about antidepressants. Thank you for talking about your journey. This is so important for many of us. My family has been ravaged by addiction and depression. Hearing you talk about your journey is a huge step forward for so many. Thank you. So,
good. Yeah.
That's what I hoped it was about. I just think it's, back when my parents... my mother was depressed and she didn't want to take any pills. And because I think there was a stigma to it. And I really think that some sort of medication could have really helped her.
Sure.
So I just thought, I'm going to be open about what I'm going through. And today I had so a month ago I had a virtual call with a nurse practitioner who's great. And it was like a 45 minute conversation. And I thought, oh, okay, because he wants to make sure you're okay and everything. And this call was 10 minutes long and just checking in, how's it feeling? She asked some key questions, super knowledgeable about everything. And we're going to up the dose a little bit. I've been taking it and what I call the hamster wheel is not nearly as present as it used to be. I've been depressed a couple times, but it hasn't been as deep. And I'm generally feeling better. And I was worrying about whether that was like a placebo thing, but my nurse practitioner said, if it's gone on this long, it's probably not a placebo thing. And then she suggested that we're going to up the dosage at just a tiny bit, and then we're going to check back in another month. So I think going forward, I'm going to have every month at just a 10-minute video call with my nurse practitioner. And that's great.
Yeah, no kidding. That hardly any time out of your day at all.
I can just go around and skip around and be happy. And
yeah,
it's not a cure-all. It's not a magic pill that's going to make all your problems go away. But it gives you time to instead of react immediately, it's like, okay, I'm just a little more level-headed. The guy that blocks the fire hydrant, I'm like, okay, I can use the 311 app on my phone to report him to the New York City and they can take it from there. And, karma is boomerang for people that block fire hydrants, basically.
Yeah.
But I don't get all wound up about it. And I go back in and sit at my desk and I'm like, oh, that guy's blocking the hydrant now. So another part of that has allowed, I think, meditation. And exercise is key for this as well. And I think the meditation also helps with that because it allows you to pause for a minute and not get super wrapped up in the little stuff. And at least with the Headspace app, it's about letting go. you know, just let go of everything and let your mind clear. And I find myself being better and better at that. I only meditate for like 10 or 15 minutes a day. I'm not like sitting there for a half an hour going woo. So that's my world. That's my world update.
Yeah. Yeah. The secret is to respond. Do not react.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Respond. Do not react. Every time I react in my life, I generally regret it at some point. Responding appropriately and measuredly and realizing that, you know, maybe people are having other problems that you don't know anything about, which is true all the time. Or, you know, that's just respond appropriately and be the kind of person that you'd want people to treat you that way. And you'll get used occasionally, and that's okay too.
Yes, the camera operator calls it charitable assumption.
Oh, but I like that.
You don't know what's going on in their life with the person that is screaming at you. You know, you just, I'm like, okay, there's something going on in this person's world that is affecting their response to me. And so I don't take it nearly as personally anymore. And I'm like, you know, there's more to this than just this person saying this thing to me. There's a reason they're saying it to me that a lot of times is there's something else going on with their world.
Yeah.
And the meditation allows me to wait now. Like, I don't answer emails right away. I just think about it, and then I might go back the next day and answer that kind of thing. Or I might, in a text, just in using the text program on the Mac, I'll write out a response, but I don't put it in an email, so I don't accidentally send it. Right. But I might write some, or I'll use the phone when I'm locking the dogs and I have an idea how to respond. I just go make a note, and I'm talking to the phone, and I dictate the couple of sentences I want to say. And that way I know, because I'll get home and I'm like, oh, I forgot that great thought I had. So now I just voicemail it, voice memo it in the phone. And then I respond later. So instead of reacting, I'm responding. That's such a great term.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say. It must not have been important. Well said, though. Just, you know, it kind of lets thing go. But, you know, I don't hesitate to call people out. I mean, when they're really wrong. But I mean, it's trying to be generous. You know, we had a case recently, just I was telling you about before we got on the air. A person took their corgi, a pretty stout dog, but took it to the dog park and put it on the big dog side. And then the snippy, snarly, playing, rough and tumble that goes on, the little dog kind of got caught in the middle of it. And I'm like, well, exactly whose fault is that? You know, your dog suffered because you made a bad choice. Put your dog on the small dog side.
Right. Know? Most dog runs have two fenced off areas, a small dog area and a big dog area. And yeah, corgis don't belong in the big dog area.
Yeah.
And, but then that person was complaining on like next door or something, or
Yeah. And wanting to have the dog banned and brought in for testing, and it was a some sort of pit bull mix, so that made it even worse, as far as public perceptions go. But you know, your dog was mauled because of your bad choice, and yep. Complaint. You know, none of the other dogs were having a problem. It was rough and tumble over there, but it was not an all out brawl kind of dog fight. Your dog just got in the middle of it. And, you know, you can't blame everybody for everybody else's, or anybody for your default. I can't say it, your defects and judgment. She will not do that again, I'm sure.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I might say, you know, I can understand you being upset. I said, but you need to also think about, and I'm careful about the words I use nowadays. I would have said, but you need to realize, you need to be aware, you know, like you just need to think about perhaps putting your dog in the smaller dog area than the larger dog. And I think they'd have a better experience.
Yeah.
And that way you're not, I'm just careful now not to make people sound like I'm insulting them, but I can still get my message across.
Yeah, that's one of the things I learned decades ago. You can say anything to anyone as long as you phrase it the right way.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest problems I see in society now. People think that they can phrase things as crudely and as bluntly as they want and suffer no consequences.
Yeah.
That's just not going to happen. People are going to probably react instead of respond to your bluster and your accusations and your foul language appropriately, or maybe not appropriately, but in kind. And you need to, if people just had a better sense of how to talk to other people, I do dislike the crude aspects of TV and stuff lately, particularly on the pay-per-view channels now, or not pay-per-view, but the paid subscription channels.
Right.
It's seems like because they want to demonstrate how free they are from the constraints of network TV and being on the FCC airwaves by saying things in such a crude manner that it just loses all impact. You know, every other word is the F word or one thing or another. And but it's like, you know, after a while I'm not easily offended and I get weary of it. I'm just tired of hearing it.
Yeah.
It loses its impact, you know. And it's not creative. I used to kind of win contests when I was policing for stringing the most explicatives together in one sentence. But it was creative work.
Yeah.
Now it's just that one word over and over and over and over. What are you watching on TV? I heard you say to Aaron, or no, to Nicole, I think, you were thinking about kind of doing reviews of TV shows.
Yeah, I watch a lot of Apple TV. We're watching I don't know the names of the shows. We're gonna have to circle back to this because I can't remember the names.
We on HBO, we were watching, just finished it last night, Perry Mason. And it's Matthew Rhys. You probably remember him from The Americans if you were following that series. And people are just so down on this show. They said, well, this is nothing like Perry Mason, which they were thinking about the Raymond Burr Perry Mason.
Right.
And what they don't realize is that Earl Stanley Gardner wrote these books. The first one was set in 1932. And so this is going back to the actual original Perry Mason. And Gardner wrote 40 books and I think a couple of shorter pieces, novellas, of the Perry Mason series. And these were all set in Depression era LA. And Perry Mason was scrounging and very much like Earl Stanley Gardner. In all the Perry Mason series, the books, there are only two pieces of backstory about Perry Mason ever. One, we find out in book three that he was a Leo. And in one of the about around 35, we find out he served in World War II on a minesweeper off some little atoll of the Pacific. And those are the only two fact pieces of history that are in the Perry Mason for his backstory. And so what the creators did, they took Earl Stanley Gardner, the author's backstory, and used it as Perry Mason's backstory in the series. And so Perry Mason didn't go to law school, neither did Earl Stanley Gardner. They both apprenticed under one lawyer, which is the way law used to be done. And then they get a sign off after a while and they take the bar. And that's how they both became lawyers. And Earl Stanley Gardner was working with minority clients and immigrants and people wrongfully convicted. He actually called his law practice when he was talking about the court of last resort. And so in this new Perry Mason series, Matthew Rays is that Perry Mason taking on hard clients, you know, in during the Depression. And so there were Hoovervilles and the whole Hoover thing is really interesting. People were making fun of Hoover at the time. And so you had Hoovervilles, and that's when, you know, Grapes of Wrath, all those Okies going to California and living in these shanty towns. You had Hoover flags, and that's pulling your pockets inside out to show you had no money or anything. Those were Hoover flags. Hoover leather, which was cardboard you stuffed into your shoes when they wore out. And then Hoover cars, which were cars that were pulled by horses and donkeys because they couldn't afford the gasoline. And all that's depicted in this series. And it's Matthew Rays was actually born to play this part. He looks the part, he talks it, he acts it. You know, the whole thing is just fascinating. And I've been talking it up just because the negative talk about it is so pervasive. But they're thinking of a Perry Mason that never really existed in the stories.
Right. They're thinking of the TV version rather than... By the way, there was a couple of books about this, you know.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm so sorry you're feeling poorly.
I feel so much better. I really do.
Yeah.
All right, so thank you, everyone. If you have some thoughts about biogas generators, that would be fun to hear from you. It's radio@gardenfork.tv. Rick and I are going to stick around for the after show for the patrons of Garden Fork Radio. There's information about that below in the show notes there. A cup of coffee a month and you get behind-the-scenes stuff. But thank you so much. It's radio@gardenfork.tv. Tell me about your biogas generator. Thank you, Rick.
Okay, talk to you later, my friend. Bye-bye.
Garden Fork Radio is produced by Garden Fork Media LLC in Brooklyn, New York. Our executive producer is Jimmy Goose. For more information about Jimmy and the custom hollow books he makes, visit hollowbooks.com. The music in the show is licensed from audioblocks.com and uniquetracks.com. Thank you.